We appreciate your interest and concern about the matters under consideration, and I think that you are concerned is really a credit to you, because it's a subject so many people are not really, have not been really concerned about until our later days. And so many are now showing concern about the matters of prophecy and how we fit into them. And your concern about that is certainly good for us to see, but it's also commendable on your part to be that way. We are especially thankful tonight to have the Reverend from Tucson. I don't know how many are here today. I don't know how small it was this morning, but it had to be total there because we had a number of you here today from Tucson. We're thankful you came. That just means that someday the church is going to pay you back when they have a meeting over there. So they'll probably look for that debt to be paid. But anyway, we're glad to have you, and we're certainly delighted to see the interest of everyone who's here and who's come to study with us during this series of meetings. The subject matter will probably be pretty long each night. I doubt seriously if I'll ever talk under an hour, and I have talked as much as 2 hours. I don't want to scare you away. We had a 5-minute intermission. But anyway, if we are going to be a little long, and probably a little bit long tonight. Tomorrow night, if you will, I'd like for you to study ahead of time chapter 7 in the book of Daniel. I'll try to get through chapter 6 tonight if possible. We are not going to delay too long in Daniel. There are several things we need to talk about, and we will later on in chapter 7 through 12. But chapter 7, 8, and 9 are extremely important. We'll take quite a bit of time to get into. So I'll read at least chapter 7 tomorrow. It wouldn't hurt to read more than that, but I think all we'll get to tomorrow night is chapter 7. So I want you to read that if you will then. And then chapter 8, perhaps chapter 9 for the following night. Tonight our study is to be taken from chapter 2 through chapter 6. Now this morning we studied chapter 1, and we gave a brief background of who Daniel was and how he fit into a time schedule that relates to his place in the Bible. We tried to talk about worldly events that led up to that. We tried to talk about events earlier in the Bible that allowed the children of Israel to have come that far in history as an intact people, and that I will continue from that point forward. Most of you were here. Some of you were not. And I won't go back in detail over that tonight, but if some of you were not here and want an outline of that, I have 7 or 8 pages I've written on it. I'll be glad to give you a copy. I think I have some. And you're welcome to that. If you were not here this morning and want a copy, by all means, you're welcome to it. We discussed this morning the fact that Daniel was one of 4 young men chosen by the king of Babylon to pay special attention to in order he might nurture and care for them and make them valuable to both him and like to the Israelites in Babylon. We noticed also this morning that Isaiah predicted, as well as others, that Israel was going into Babylonian captivity for 70 years, and then they would return. And then God would take vengeance on Babylon, and he'd destroy them as he did. And they had never again risen to the power they one time were. This happened in 587 down to 517 when the temple was rebuilt in Jerusalem. And it was that same temple that remained intact. It had to have remodeling jobs done on it. It was damaged, but it remained intact as a temple until 70 AD, at which time it was destroyed again by the Romans. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in chapter 9 and a great deal more later on, I suppose, in our studies. So we are talking now about a time of roughly the middle of the 500s in the B.C. era. And we're going to try to see tonight further the things that took place in the life of Daniel, or which took place shortly after he died. And then tomorrow night, from that point forward, we're going to talk about things that were happening then, and that were fulfilled much, much greater in a later era of time, even down to the end of the world. So tomorrow night forward, we're going to be talking in Daniel about prophecy of events that were at that time future. At this time, most of those have occurred, but at that time it was future. Tonight, however, we're going to still talk about Daniel's presence, about the events that surrounded him and the kings under which he served during the time, basically, of the 500s and into the 400s. In the B.C. era. Now, chapter 2 tells us that we're talking now about the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, as many people dream dreams, of course, and he had a problem, though. Not only did he dream a dream, but he forgot what the dream was. He wanted to know 2 things. He wanted to know what the dream was, first of all, the dream he'd forgotten, and then what does that dream mean? I'm sure some of you have had dreams before. And if they're like some of my dreams, they are oddball dreams. You can dream just about most anything. It doesn't make a bit of sense in the world. They're all twisted up. They don't come out right. But you know what? I've never been killed in a dream yet. Almost. I've been rolled over, and I don't know what all has happened to me, and I've had things almost crush me, but they didn't. I woke up just in the nick of time. I always wonder what would happen if I went another 3 minutes. But anyway, I woke up, and I didn't get killed. Brother Jim told me about some of his dreams, and he had some oddball dreams, too. I'm sure you have. Well, Nebuchadnezzar dreams that were oddball, too, I'm sure, from his point of view, because he didn't know what they were. And I think if you dreamed the dream he dreamed, you'd probably be very scared about it, too. He wanted to know what it meant. Now, dreams back in those times were important in some cases because God, through a dream, revealed to the person dreaming or to someone else who told him what it dreamed, what the dream was, what it meant, some important event in the person's lives or in the history of the country in which they were concerned, with which they were concerned. And that's the case here. Nebuchadnezzar dreamed a dream. He'd forgotten it, didn't know what it was. And so he called in all those men of his realm who should be able to do such a thing as interpret a dream. The Chaldeans, the astrologers, the soothsayers, the magicians, and if we can put another word there just for sake of understanding, fortune tellers. That's the kind of thing a soothsayer was. It was a situation where he wanted to know what I dreamed and then what it means. So he called all those in, and of course none of them, as you might well know, could answer. Verse 5 says, "The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, 'The thing is gone from me. If you will not make known unto me the dream, with the interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill.'" Pretty gruff. Pretty rude. But he meant it. And they were afraid. He said, "If ye show the dream and the interpretation thereof, ye shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and the interpretation thereof." So they answered Nebuchadnezzar again. They said, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation of it." But in verse 8, the king said, "I knew of certainty that ye would gain the time, because ye see the thing's gone from me. You see that I'm at a disadvantage. I don't know what my dream was." Now, if I told you what my dream was, you could feign some answer to it. You could give me an idea of what it was. You could guess at it even. But I want you to tell me what the dream was and what it meant. Now, if you're a magician, if you're a real astrologer, if you know about these kind of things, you can tell me that. And if you're a fraud, then you can't. And I'll just cut your head off. Well, that would be a pretty hard answer to make. They couldn't answer it. He said, "But if you will not make known to me the dream, there is but one decree for you. For ye have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me, till the time be changed. Therefore tell me the dream, and I shall know that ye can tell me the interpretation thereof." And of course the Chaldeans answered and said, "No man can do that, because such power as that only lies in God's, and they don't live with flesh." And then verse 12 says, "For this cause the king was angry and very furious, and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon." Now, Daniel was a wise man. Not that kind of a wise man, but he was a wise man. He'd been blessed by God. God had raised him to a position to where he was respected by the king. And now he has been brought in before the king as an elected by the king, one of four young men who were very choice young men captured from Jerusalem. And so the decree went forward to take all of the wise men, which would include Daniel, and kill them, because they cannot tell me what I want to know. So when they came to get Daniel and his companions, verse 15, he answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree so hasty from the king?" Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. Daniel apparently hadn't even heard about it. Then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. And that's reasonable. And the king listened to it and granted it. Then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Now, I like what you have done here tonight, and you do continually, in praying for things that sometimes people think are minor. I really don't think that necessarily I should thank the Lord for allowing me to beat the tennis game against Linda. I've never done it, and he never blessed me with that, so I guess that's not something I should pray about. Or maybe pray that something real good will happen to me, like inherit $1 million. I think that would be frivolous. But to pray for the childbirth and to pray for journeys that people are taking with a good interested mind, to pray for the sister in Mexico Those things are ideal. But I think you see also in this that Daniel and his companions also were people of prayer. God people throughout the ages have been people of prayer. Prayer is a way we communicate with God. It's a way we praise God. Fasting, I think, to put it in my terms, is nothing more than an extension of prayer. It's more than prayer. It's deeper than prayer. It involves more than prayer, but it's an extension of prayer and has the same effect with God. It shows God our contrite heart and that we want to reach out to Him. And we see prayer a number of times in Daniel, in Esther, in the New Testament era. We see fasting a number of times. But in this particular case, Daniel, his companions prayed to God. The verse 19 says, "Then was the secret revealed to Daniel in a night vision." You see, a day vision is when a person might have in a trance or might see something that he's not would not see normally at another time. A night vision, very well, is a dream. But anyway, he saw this vision at night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. He thanked God for it. How many times when we pray do we stop and say, "Lord, You did what I asked You to, and I thank You for it"? How many times have you said, "Lord, You didn't do what I thought I ought to have done for me, but I thank You for it anyway, because I know Your choice is best"? You know, I pray that way sometimes, because many, many times my way is not the best way. But in this case, though, God told Daniel what the dream was. And then he says, and this is extremely important, "He changes the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise, and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in darkness, and the light dwelleth with him." He continues, "I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who has given me wisdom and might, and hast made known unto me now what we desire of thee. For thou hast now made known unto us the king's matters." Now, this same wording almost is going to be found a little bit later on, but this time it applies to Nebuchadnezzar, and we'll see how it works there. We see how it fit here. "Therefore Daniel went in unto the king's messenger, the Arioch, the one who had been ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said unto him, 'Destroy not the wise men of Babylon, bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation.' Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said unto him, 'I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known to the king the interpretation.'" Well, I'm sure the king was happy and joyful over that. He answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, that is, in the Babylonian way of thinking it was, "Art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof?" How would you have answered that question? Beautifully answered by Daniel. Listen to what he said. "Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, 'The secret which the king hath demanded, cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers show unto the king? But there is a God of heaven.'" See, Daniel didn't say, "Oh, yeah, I can show you. You know, I'm somebody special. You've chosen the right man." He didn't do that. Daniel knew where the answer came from. He knew that he served God. He was simply a servant of God. He said, "These people that you have selected cannot show that. But there's a God of heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and the vision of thy head upon thy bed are these." So you see, Daniel gives God credit, and we should in all things. Everything we do should be done to the glory and praise of Almighty God. I mean everything. I don't care what it is. If I get a raise, I thank God for it. Or I used to when I got raises. If I am without a job and get a new job, I thank God for it. You know, I thank God many times when I didn't have a wreck. Sometimes I miss a wreck now and then pretty close, and I thank Him for that. We ought to be thankful people. And if we are thankful people, you know what we're doing? Did you bring a pillar? I think right now it's going to be 2 hours tonight if I keep this up. Anyway, the fact is, when God blesses us, give Him credit and glory for it, because we didn't do it, He did. And when we humble ourselves before God, it shows that we are His servants. It shows we acknowledge where our source of power comes from. And you know what? God likes that. He wants us to be His subject and to give Him honor and glory, and we should. And that's what Daniel is doing just here. Daniel goes into the king now and says, "Here's what your dream was. Thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed. What should come to pass hereafter? And he that revealeth secrets maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. But as for me, the secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have, more than any other, or any living, but for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou knowest, or mightest know the thoughts of thine heart. So Daniel again says, I'm not really the one who's doing this, but it's God through me. And that's the way God works. Jesus went to heaven saying that we were going to be able to perform greater things than he could do. And the reason why is not that he didn't have the power, but he wouldn't be able to do it, because he left the teaching and the spread of the truth to us. Now, God could have told Nebuchadnezzar this from heaven in a booming, mighty voice, but he didn't. He used a human vessel to do it through, and so he works to us today. Then Daniel said, here, O king, is what you saw, a great image. He said, the great image, whose brightness and excellence stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. The image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floor, the wheat straw that you blow away, that which is in wheat or in some grain that you are thrashing, you don't want to cook. So it's blown away. In their day, they had a big fan they would blow that with. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them, for these kingdoms, or for these metals and these parts of the image you saw. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Now remember that verse, because later on, throughout our studies, we're going to talk about mountains. Now what are mountains? Well, you'll see in just a moment. The mountain here is not something like which is behind me with snow on it. The mountain spoken of here is something far, far different from that, but it's symbolic language. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. The next verse, Daniel starts now to tell the answer to the problem. On the board to my left, we have written something that we're going to summarize from what Daniel says and draw this from secular history to put it into terms we could very easily understand. He said, thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. So, Nebuchadnezzar, you are under consideration here, and you are this king of kings. You are the head of gold. Now, I want you to notice something about this as we continue on. We have gold, silver, brass, iron, and then clay. Now, if you look at the qualities I had just mentioned, you'll find that these are minerals. Brother Jim here is a geologist. He told me a long time ago that what I thought was a rock was not a rock. I thought a rock was something you reached out on the ground and picked up, and you could throw it if you wanted to. That's all I thought a rock was. He tells me no. He said a rock must be a combination of at least two minerals. Then it becomes a rock, and of course that's true. Here you have minerals, but what's the value of these minerals? You have gold, which is most valuable, more than silver, which follows it. Silver, however, is more valuable than the brass, which followed it. And then iron, last of all here, is the least in value of any of those. And then we notice also another thing, though, about it. We notice that gold, even though it's more valuable, is the weakest of any of these we mentioned. Gold, in its pure form, is very, very flexible. It must be mixed with an alloy. If you have a gold ring on, it's not pure gold. You might have thought it was, but it's not. It's been mixed with something to make it stay in the shape that it's in, and to stay in a form that you can wear it and use it. Otherwise, it would not be that way at all. It's very, very weak as far as strength is concerned. But it's also very durable, and that's the reason they put it in people's teeth. But we have gold, more valuable, but less in strength. Silver, less value than gold, but stronger than gold. Brass, still less in value, but much, much stronger than silver. And finally, iron. Not very costly at all, but stronger than all, though. You can take a piece of iron and literally beat a piece of gold to pieces. Gold can't stand up to iron, but on the other hand, it's far more valuable. Now, if you notice the ascending and descending order of these minerals, you'll see something important. Now, last of all, he brings forth to us a stone. How much is a stone worth? Just an old rock you find out in the yard. Not much, is it? And yet, this stone becomes something extremely important, as you'll see, and more valuable really than all these in the ultimate end. He continues on and talks about Nebuchadnezzar in verse 38. Wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beast of the field, the fowl of the air, hath God given into thine hands. hath made thee the ruler over them all, thou art this head of gold. Nebuchadnezzar was one of the greatest rulers who's ever lived. Not great in every sense, but in the sense that he conquered the then known world. He was one who had his fingertips and the snap of his finger, whatever he desired. He built, as you might recall, one of the great wonders of the ancient world called the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Very interesting, but none of us, of course, ever have or ever will see it. It's long since passed away, but one of the notable things of ancient history. So Nebuchadnezzar is pictured, first of all, and Nebuchadnezzar, as you well know from our study this morning, came on the scene to invade Jerusalem in 606 B.C. And then verse 39 tells us, after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toe, part of clay and part of iron, there's something about this kingdom signified by this clay and iron being together in the feet and toes. There shall be in it the strength of the iron. But at the same time, as you saw that iron was mixed with miry clay, he says, as the toes and the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. There's going to be a weakness in this last fourth kingdom, and that weakness, he says, is symbolized by iron and clay, which does not mix together. When you mention the toes, which of course would be 10 in this case, there are those who make a great deal to do over the 10 toes of whatever this symbolizes. I don't see that. Now, I will admit that later on in the book of Revelation and later on in Daniel, we're going to talk about 10, but it's not 10 toes, it's 10 horns. Now, I can very easily tell you what these 10 horns could mean. You would probably accept it, and it would fit with the 10 horns. I could very easily do that because it will fit. But it won't fit in the sense that the Bible says it, so I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to suggest that this represents the 10 parts of the Roman Empire that with the horns later on will. Because it doesn't say it, doesn't even intimate it here, because later on he talks about that with a horn. So I'm not going to suggest that to you. Although some commentators and some of those who write about these matters do say the 10 horns represent the division into 10 parts of the Roman Empire. I don't think that's what this is talking about. I think it simply shows that he's talking about feet which have 10 horns. I'm sorry. Yeah, I got my tongue tangled again, didn't I? Do that every once in a while. I'm sorry. Well, erase it out and start over when you know. See, anyway, I meant 10 toes. Verse 44, though, says, in the days of these kings, the kings who are represented by the iron, in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. It shall stand forever. Now let's stop just there a moment and look at the board. Here we see there was the head of gold, which history tells us, and Daniel also says, is the king of Babylon. And history tells us that Babylon was on the scene as a world power from 606 to 539. Now take that same principle we just suggested on the board, and we're going to go through the rest of those two and see what happened. Babylon was defeated, as you'll see tonight in chapter 5, by Darius the Mede as he came on the scene and diverted the waters from under the walls of Babylon and marched through on the riverbed and conquered the city that had not and could not be conquered. But he did it. And that was in 539. The name of this ruler was Darius. He was working with closely Cyrus, of whom we read a number of times and will later on. The belly, the breast and the arms were of silver, symbolizing the next kingdom that would arise, and these was the Medes and the Persians. Now, later on, we're going to find the distinction between Medes and Persians and what that means. However, right now, combine it together because that's the next world empire that came on the scene and succeeded Babylon as a world empire. And this empire existed from 539 until 331. Not very long at all, but that's the way world empires are. This is where Darius III was defeated in the Battle of Arbela, and this was a battleground. You can still find it on some of your maps, October 1st in 331 B.C. The next kingdom now that comes on the scene is represented by brass. Inferior to the Medes and the Persians in the sense of the value spoken of here, but much, much mightier in that at that time, Alexander, who's the king under consideration here, conquered the then known world, and as you know the story, probably sat down and cried because he had no other kingdoms to conquer. Alexander died, of course, when he was a very young man returning from a trip to India. And so Greece now comes on the scene, and Greece is defeated in the year 168 by the Romans, and this battle was at a place called Pydna in Macedonia. So we have now the three kingdoms coming in line, as the Bible has mentioned them, and as world history also outlines them precisely as Daniel, before they ever arose, tells us how they were to come. So you see, Daniel tells us ahead of time, many, many years ahead of time, what's going to happen. Now, world historians who do not know who Daniel was, who have no respect for Daniel, who don't believe in God or the Bible, world historians writing facts they have observed and have known because of earlier writings, tell us exactly what happened, and it fits the Bible precisely. That's the reason this morning we said that Daniel and Revelation, as beautiful as they are, written in symbolic language, tell us the future before it occurs, but it doesn't tell us the details. It doesn't identify those things exactly for us, except in symbolic language, but history comes along and tells us precisely what they meant so we can see where we are on the road to eternity. So it is, prophecy is history before it occurred. History is what happened, and it fits perfectly with prophecy. The fourth kingdom which came on the scene is the kingdom of Rome. It came on the scene when it defeated Greece in 168, and it came on down to finally emerge as the conqueror of Jerusalem, and they walked into that territory in 64 B.C. So we're coming down from about the middle of the 500s now all the way to the first century B.C. in our study. Now God tells Daniel to tell Nebuchadnezzar that in the days of these kingdoms, not Babylon, not Medes and the Persians, not the Grecians, but in the days of these kings we've just been talking about, Rome, shall the God of heaven set up his kingdom, and it will never be destroyed. He said it won't be left to other people. Now watch this. Babylon was left to the Medes and Persians. The Medes and Persians and their territory and their power was left to Greece. Greece was left to Rome. In fact, Rome in many, many ways incorporated the language and the architectural qualities of Greece and carried on that for some time. But each of these kingdoms were left to someone else, except Rome, which the Bible tells us disintegrated, in effect. There were conquerors who came from outside and finally subdued it. But in effect, they controlled themselves to the point at which they were conquered by outside forces. But inwardly is where their weakness was. And then in the days of Rome, shall the God of heaven himself, this little stone cut out without hands, shall smite the image in the feet. You see, the head, the breast, the arms, the feet. This stone will strike the image in the feet. It will grow to be a great mountain to fill the entire world. He said, it will not be left to other people like the other kingdoms were. It won't be left to anybody. It'll stand forever. He's talking here about the kingdom of God. And thus we have in Daniel chapter 2 a very beautiful prediction of the coming of the Lord's church. And of course the time schedule is precisely right. Rome comes to Jerusalem in 64 B.C. It is at this place where Christ is born. And it is 30 years later where the Lord's church is established. And so we have here a very beautiful outline, really, of God's plan throughout the ages for the coming forth of the kingdom, and tells us the kings will rule at the time it's established. And thus Nebuchadnezzar, seeing these things, is greatly astonished and pleased at what he sees. Verse 44, I think, should be read. For as much as I saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. The dream is certain, the interpretation thereof sure. Nebuchadnezzar was thrilled over what he had heard. He heard his dream, and he heard the interpretation of it. And so they greatly blessed Daniel when this had occurred. And Daniel is raised in rank and power to be under Nebuchadnezzar. And he asked that his three friends also be set over provinces, and they were blessed as well. You see, Daniel didn't forget his friends either. Christians don't forget their friends or their enemies. So we have here a prediction given to Nebuchadnezzar by Daniel, through Daniel by God, of a great pattern of something that's going to occur throughout the generations from that time forward. Now later on, as we continue in Daniel, several things are going to fit the pattern we have laid here for us. This is a general pattern we're going to follow from the rest of Daniel and on through Revelation, because we see here the area of time at which these four kingdoms filled and the place they filled, and it's going to be extremely important in the future. So we need to know those dates and what took place there. The scene changes now to chapter 3. Here Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. Now this image is one that he made himself. It was a very great image in size, 60 cubits. A cubit, as you might know, is the measurement, as many measurements were back in those times, of either a man's body or a horse, or something where he might be able to have a rule of measurement, because you see they didn't make yardsticks and rulers back then like we do. So a cubit would be the measurement from a man's elbow to the tip of his finger. In most cases, it would be about 18 inches, some more, some less. But at least it was some type of a measurement that would be somewhat uniform. So it says here this image was to be 60, which means 60 cubits. Now, 60 cubits would be whatever a cubit is by 60 times. Since a cubit is a foot and a half, it would be 60 plus a half, which would be 90 feet. So we have a very, very great image that Nebuchadnezzar has built. The breadth thereof, he says, was 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar now has seen the power of God and has acknowledged the fact that Daniel serves God, but Nebuchadnezzar has not learned his lesson. Nebuchadnezzar still is a believer of many gods, and of the one God he has not yet come to the point of understanding. And so he builds a god, and of course back in those days they were recognized as many, many gods present. I suppose Nebuchadnezzar merely thought of Jehovah as one more of many gods, and that Daniel was his servant. And the reason why is because now he builds an image to a god, and he desires that all of his domain bow before this god. However, in the book of Acts chapter 17, there's a very interesting reading that we can have from what Paul wrote. He spoke there about the people who were in ignorance and who were serving unknown gods. And they had an altar made among many other gods present there, at least in their mind, one they didn't know for sure about. And so they made this to the unknown God. Paul came through and very wisely said, now you admit you don't understand this God. You don't know it because you say you don't, because the very title you put over there. I know about that God. I want to tell you about it. And so Paul continued further. Then he said that this God that I'm speaking of dwells not in temples made with hands as though he needed anything, and neither is he honored by men making things for him, Paul went on to say. God does not need us, we need him. He was trying to show that the temples and the idols and the images that we make are simply stone structures or whatever they might be made of. They don't move, they don't talk, they go nowhere, they do nothing except as we ourselves make them do it. So what we have done throughout centuries, that is people in general, have erected images and idols and things of that nature of our own creation, and then we bow before them and worship a God we have made. How foolish that is. When a person builds an altar to a God which doesn't exist, or builds an image to a God that is not there, and worships that image, he is extremely foolish, because his own reasoning ought to say, I made this, how can I worship something I made with my own power, and I must have been greater than he was, or else he couldn't exist without me. But that's not the same with God. You see, our God can exist and did exist without us. He doesn't need us, but kindly he made us for his pleasure. And that's what is under consideration right here, and what Nebuchadnezzar is about to learn. So Nebuchadnezzar commanded that there be a great bowing and reverence of the God he had made. The herald cried aloud, verse 4 says, to you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, all kind of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Whoso falleth not down and worship shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. So, when the musical instrument sounded, the people ought to bow before this image. But as that was done, and as those who were serving the king noticed, there were three men who would not do that. Now, they, of course, were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And it is said to the king in verse 12, O king, have not regarded thee, they serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring them to me. And then they brought these three servants of God before Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, in verse 14, asked them if it was true that you won't fall down before my God. And they said, of course, that it was. But here's what they said, verse 15, or what he said. Ready, now, if ye be ready, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. But if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning, fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? I think you can see here the greatness which is felt for himself by Nebuchadnezzar, and the fury he feels toward those who won't do what he says. But Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, they wisely answer the question, the latter part of verse 16. We are not careful to answer thee in this matter. Now, they didn't mean by that we don't care what we say. They meant that we're not going to take caution and try to answer you some way that will free us. But we're going to tell you exactly like it is. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. Pretty positive, aren't they? But look at the next verse. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. What they're saying in effect is this. We know the God we believe in. He is there. He is real. He's the only God. And if he sees fit to save us from your threat, he'll do it. But if we're not saved, that doesn't mean he doesn't exist. It simply means he just doesn't see fit to save us. Now, that's faith. That's absolute faith. Let's say we don't care what happens here. God is, and we're his children, and we won't do what you say against our God. I think probably you can see here now, the man who is the greatest, most powerful man on the earth from a secular point of view is before them. And they're saying, we just won't do what you say. He has power to do anything he wants to with them. And he's about to do that. He, in his fury, his rage, he says, you heat that furnace 7 times more than it ought to be. And he got the mightiest men in his army. He bound them up with their clothing so that they were in a position now to be thrown into the fire. Verse 21 says, these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent, and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men, the mighty men of the army, which took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. So Nebuchadnezzar has accomplished his purpose. His anger has been rewarded by destroying those who would listen to him. Or has it? The next verse says, then Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and rose up in haste and spake and said unto his counselors, did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, true, O king. He answered and said, lo, I see 4 men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt. Now, they should have died. The men who thrown them in there died immediately. They didn't even get in the fire. And yet we find these 3 men walking around and somebody else with them. And he says, the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Now that should make somebody think. And it did Nebuchadnezzar. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake unto said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth of the midst of the fire. Now, we find that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were spared from the awful situation that they faced. They were spared because they did have a God And because that God was theirs and they respected him, because they saw fit to serve him regardless of what came their way, and this proved to the greatest men on the earth, from a secular point of view at least, that God is, God lives, he is there, and he's the only one. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar here acknowledges that same God by calling him on him as the God. But what about that fourth character in the furnace? Who is that? Well, it says that he is like the Son of God. It's very easy here to see Jesus in that fire, and that Jesus is the one who came to save them from their destruction, and so we see him in the Old Testament. But it just doesn't say that. That's just not there. Sometimes in the Bible we very easily can read things into it that are just not there. It didn't say that. It said the Son of God. And here the translator put a capital. But you see, the Greek did not have capitals or small letters. It didn't even have punctuation. I've seen a translation from the 5th century. It's written by a line of letters, and there's not even a space between the letters. So the translator put the capital S here, not God. So this person they saw was like the form of the Son of God. And I think we can very easily find out who that is by some looking in various places about it. But verse 28 really tells us who it was. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God." Simply an angel. Simply an angel. Well, perhaps I shouldn't say simply, because it was an angel, God's angel. God's angel was there, and God sent the angel there. Now, I don't think this was Jesus. Of course, I'm sure he was present in the sense that Jesus was in existence. He's at God's right hand now and was then. The fact is, this was an angel, so the book of Daniel tells us in verse 28. And so Nebuchadnezzar now admits there is one God. It is this God. And then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were promoted in the province of Babylon, so verse 30 tells us. Chapter 4 now changes the scene again, and this time, chapter 4 tells us again about Nebuchadnezzar, still on the throne. He was a king unto all peoples, nations, tongues. And he says, as he writes or declares, "Peace be multiplied unto you. I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that our high God hath wrought toward me." And then talking about the things that have been done for him and through him, and in which he had a hand, he says, "How great are his signs, how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. His dominion is from generation to generation." Then it continues, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and flourishing in my palace. I saw..." Go ahead and change. He talks about the things that he can see that have to do with his presence in the world. He says, "I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts upon my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore made I decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, they might make known unto me the interpretation of the dream." And once again they come in. However, Daniel now is the one who comes in at the last, verse 8. And Daniel is able to tell him some things he needs to know about what he's able to see. "O Belshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know the spirit of the holy gods is in thee." Verse 9. Nebuchadnezzar has not learned his lesson yet. Nebuchadnezzar has seen Daniel interpret the dream once. He has already seen by means of the burning fiery furnace that God of heaven rules and Daniel his servant, but he still uses the term gods, not the God, but gods. He hasn't learned his lesson yet, but he's about to. He said, "I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in thee, and no secret troubleth thee. Tell me the visions of my dream that I have seen and the interpretation thereof." Now this time he remembers the dream, and he begins to tell about the dream in verse 10. "Thus were the visions of mine head in my bed. I saw and behold a tree in the midst of the earth. The height thereof was great. The tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto heaven, and the sight thereof to the end of all the earth. The leaves thereof were fair, the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all. The beasts of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof, and all flesh was fed of it. I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, and behold, a watcher and an holy one came down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus, hew down the tree, and cut off his branches, shake off his leaves, and scatter his fruit. So that great tree you saw is literally torn apart. Let the beast get away from under it, and the fowls from its branches. The tree which has been so helpful and beneficial, and has such enormous effect with the birds and the fowls around, and has given fruit, all of a sudden that tree is just shattered. Nevertheless, he says, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven. Let his portion be with the beast of the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast heart be given to him, and let seven times pass over him. This matters by decree of the watchers, and demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living might know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basis of men. Daniel says this, Nebuchadnezzar says, this dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now thou, O Belteshazzar, declare the interpretation thereof, for as much as all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known unto me the interpretation, but thou art able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in thee. So Daniel again is approached by being the servant of merely one of many gods. Then Daniel sought time to think about these matters. And then finally, in the latter part of verse 19, he says, Nebuchadnezzar, the interpretation of this dream is something you're not going to like, because what I'm going to tell you is really to the advantage of those who don't like you, to your enemies, and it's against you. And then he says, though, what it was. Verse 20, the tree that thou sawest, which grew and was strong, whose height reached unto the heaven, and the sight thereof to all the earth, whose leaves were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all, under which the beast of the field dwelt, and upon whose branches the fowl of the heaven had their habitation. It is thou, O king, that art grown and become strong, for thy greatness is good and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion to the end of the earth. Whereas the king saw a watcher and a holy one coming down from heaven, and saying, hew the tree down and destroy it, yet leave the stump and the roots thereof in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beast of the field, till seven times pass over him. Daniel repeats what has already been seen in the dream. He says, this is interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which is come upon my lord, the king. Now, quite often we see that band of brass and iron in various commentators, and this by them is taken to represent something, but I want you to notice that if it does, then the other things too must stand for something. But let us proceed on. Daniel says, verse 25, that they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know, and this is the key to it, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. Now Daniel has already learned that lesson, and he told God, I know that, you remember, back in chapter 2. But now Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar, this lesson is something you don't know, and you haven't found out yet, and although you should have been exposed to it, in effect, he's saying, but you haven't learned that yet, and God's going to tell you that. Whereas thou commandest to leave the, they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee, after that thou shalt make known what the heavens do, that the heavens do rule. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee. Daniel says, now here's what you have heard, that you are this tree, and you're going to be cut out. But now your kingdom's going to be preserved. It won't be taken away from you, but for 7 years you won't have it. And you'll be out in the field like this dream has said you would be, like an oxen eating grass. You won't be in your right frame of mind. You won't be functioning as a human would normally do. For 7 years, this is going to be your plight. But then after that time, you will be restored to your kingdom. Daniel says, now, this is my advice to you. And if you follow my advice, you'll be well off. But Nebuchadnezzar doesn't. Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee, and break off thy sins, thy righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if it may be a lengthening of thy tranquility. You see, God has allowed this several times. He allowed this to Sodom and Gomorrah, and they didn't listen. He allowed it to Nineveh, and they did. Now, when God issues a decree that is an awful decree, punishment, sorrow, and harm follows in that prediction, if the person involved will change, God always changes his will. But God's a God of mercy as well as a God of justice. God's a God of kindness as well as he one of strength and exactness. And Daniel was telling Nebuchadnezzar, if you'll only humble yourself, turn away from your sins, this won't happen to you. So my advice is, humble yourself, turn away from your sins, acknowledge God, and what we have said won't happen. And then verse 28 says, all this came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar. But here's how it happened. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. He has seen to have, before this time, knowledge of God, but he didn't glean from what he saw. Now he's had 12 whole months to bask in his own joy and happiness as the greatest man on the earth, the most powerful, the richest. He begins to talk about that now in verse 30. The king spake and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? So Nebuchadnezzar is really boasting. He's proud of himself. Look at all I have done, he says. While the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, thy kingdom is departed from thee. I wonder what Nebuchadnezzar thought, if he had time to think. Because the voice says, they'll drive you from men, thy dwelling shall be the beast of the field, they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, seven times shall pass over thee, until thou knowest the Most High rooteth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And that very same hour, the next verse says, these things happened to Nebuchadnezzar, and for 7 years he suffered this condemnation. The reason I know that seven times is 7 years is because of one thing. A man whose name was Josephus, who was present in the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, right outside of the city, he was not in it. He was present there, knew of it, and in his commenting on Daniel, in the beautiful work that he produced and we still have available today, he said that seven times were 7 years. And this is a view of the old Jews, and of course it fits beautifully with what we see here. So Nebuchadnezzar now is led out into the field to live as an ox would live and as a beast would live, so he might be brought down to his knees and understand. Verse 36, Nebuchadnezzar says, into that time, the same time my reason returned unto me, and for the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and brightness returned unto me, my counselors and my lord sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. Nebuchadnezzar says, when all this was done, my kingdom was preserved, and I again began to rule in it. You see, the band of iron simply meant that this stump which stays there when the tree is cut down means that you'll come back into your glory, and that at one time you'll continue to reign as you did before. But the brass and the iron are given no significance whatsoever. And so while some commentators would like to say that this is Persia and are agreed, it just doesn't say that here, so we can't suggest that either. It simply shows the ban was around the stump to preserve the stump of the kingdom until Nebuchadnezzar was able at his right mind to return. And then in verse 37, we find Nebuchadnezzar's final understanding of God. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment. And those that walk in pride, he is able to abase. I hope he learned his lesson. But we don't know, because from that point forward, we read nothing more of Nebuchadnezzar. But there are some interesting things in chapter 5, very interesting things which take place. Now, the first verse tells us that now Belshazzar is on the throne. Belshazzar is, it says, the son of the king. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before 1,000. Belshazzar, whilst he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father. Now, look at the word father. Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives, his concubines might drink therein. So at this great feast he was having, and they are using all of the vessels brought from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and they were brought by Nebuchadnezzar, whom here is called his father. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the God of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem. And the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods. He hasn't learned yet either. Nebuchadnezzar and his family still have not apparently learned the fact that there is one God. The gods of gold and silver, brass, iron, wood, and stone, they praised in these vessels they were drinking from. But the same hour came forth the fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. If all of a sudden tonight we would see a man's hand begin to write on this wall over here, what would you do? You know, I'm inclined to think I'd do exactly the same thing he did. What did he do? Would you be amazed? Would you say, look there, isn't that unusual? I've never seen that before. No, I wouldn't do that. If I saw a man's hand begin to write, I think I'd do the same thing he did. And here's what he did. Then the king's countenance was changed. All the color left his face, I think. Didn't say that. But if his countenance was changed, he wasn't smiling, he was not happy. All of a sudden, he is sober, stone sober. His thoughts troubled him, so the joints of his loin were loosed, and his knees smote one against another. His knees knocked. He was so afraid, and he had reason to. He had a lot of reason to, because he had never acknowledged God and was not about to now, until all of a sudden he's caused to do that, but it's too late. And sometime when we find out what we're doing, come to our senses and realize that I've been going the wrong way all my life, and I haven't seen fit to change, sometime it comes too late. Even when we find out, it's too late. Because we have allowed ourselves to be so taken in by the affairs of sin that our time is wasted. Verse 7 says, the king cried aloud to bring in, same people again, astrologers, Chaldeans, soothsayers, same old people still there that were there in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. And so he asked them to tell me what that means. And he said, if you do that, now watch this carefully. If you tell me what that means, he says, you will be clothed with scarlet. You'll have a chain of gold about your neck, and you'll be made the third. Remember that. It's important. You'll be made the third ruler in the kingdom. Now, before I go further, let me suggest this to you. If you would read the ancient works of history, which record the days of Babylon, the kings of Babylon, you would find nothing whatsoever about King Belshazzar. You wouldn't find the first word about him. Just not there. So those who want to criticize the Bible and say that we're all wet and what we believe about God tell us that the reason you're all wet is because Daniel is just not true. Daniel has an error in it. Among other errors, this is one outstanding error. He says Belshazzar was king of Babylon, and there never was a king in Babylon named Belshazzar. So with that in mind, they discount Daniel and say the Bible's wrong. Now, I'm going to agree with them. If they can find that the Bible is wrong, I won't believe it either. If they can find the Bible is wrong here, how do I know that it's not wrong about Jesus Christ, or about heaven, or about his protection and care of his people, or about angels, or anything else? So if we can find an error in the Bible, I'm going to throw it away. I can write something and make errors. You just seldom make an error while I go in my speech. I make errors all the time. Now, if they made errors, and I make errors, I'm as good as they are, or as bad as they are. So, is the Bible right, or is world history right? History says there was no king. And critics of the Bible absolutely say there was no king named Belshazzar. Therefore, the Bible is wrong. Well, let's go a little farther and see what we can find out, because we certainly want to get the whole picture, don't we? And, of course, none of those could tell the king what took place. But in verse 10, the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house, and the queen spake and said, O king, live forever, which is a common phrase used back in those days, and it was used by Esther. It was used by a number of people as they come to approach a king. Let's see. Bathsheba, when she came to visit David on one occasion, told him to live forever. So it's a common way of saying things. And then she said, though, let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. Well, how could they help but do that? And she says, well, I have the solution for you. There is a man in thy kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say, thy father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. For as much as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. So all of a sudden, Belteshazzar is spoken to by the queen, and she says, Belteshazzar can tell you what your problem is, because he was able to do that back at the time of your father. And then verse 13 says that Daniel was sent for. The king spake to Daniel, told him the same thing he told the others. If you can tell me what I want to know and what this means, then if that happens, I'm going to do as I told the others I would do to them. I'll clothe you in scarlet, I'll put a chain around your neck, and I'll make you the third, circle that again in your mind at least, the third ruler in the kingdom. And so Daniel answered and said to the king, let thy gifts be to thyself, and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing of the king, and make known to him the interpretation. So Daniel now is called for, and he begins to tell the king what the king wants to know. I want to know why the king did not know of Daniel. Why the king was not aware of what Daniel had done, or where Daniel was, or what was going on with him. Why is it that we don't have the king being aware of Daniel's presence, and the queen has to tell him about it? Well, for one thing, I want you to notice that the queen likely was not his wife, because he mentions in here his wives and his concubines, and then she was not at the party. She was not at the banquet. And when she heard about what was going on, then she came, whoever the queen was. It's highly suggestive there that she was not his wife, but likely his mother or grandmother. And like the people in England, they would call her the queen mother. Because, you see, she had memory of these things, and Belshazzar did not. Indicating he was younger and had not been there and had the experience that she had had back in the days of Belshazzar. Also, quite often in the Bible, we read of a father being spoken of when he was not a father, or a son or daughter being spoken of as such when they were not really sons or daughters. That's not unusual. We do that today, too. If I were to introduce a number of those in my family to someone who doesn't know them, I would have my son, my daughters, and my grandchildren with me. I'd say, these are my children. Technically, they were not. Technically, I had grandchildren, not children, there, as well as my children. And also, I would have in-laws there, but I'd call them my children. Now, we all do that. It's a common way to do things, and that was coming back in the Bible times, too. But one reason I know that's because back in the book of 1 Samuel 18, you remember that Saul was a king, and that Saul spoke about David and spoke of him as being my son. And also the book of Ruth, if you remember the story. Lovely, lovely story in Ruth. And here, when Ruth is a stranger in a strange land, and Naomi comes to visit the land with her sons and her father, her husband. Her sons and her husband dies, but Ruth has married in the meantime one of the sons. Then as they're about to go back, Ruth is spoken of by Naomi as my daughter, as well as her daughter, her sister-in-law was too. Both of the two girls there from Moab were spoken of as daughters of Naomi, but technically they were not. They were daughters-in-law. They were spoken of as daughters. The Bible has that in a number of places. There happen to be two of them here. Same thing is true in the book of Luke chapter 16. You remember that here the rich man speaks of Father Abraham. Now, Abraham had not lived on the earth for 2,000 years at that time. And yet he's spoken of his father, Abraham. He's talking about the long line of descent of which Abraham was a father. And technically, he was a father of a rich man a long, long time in the past. So many times you speak about lines of descent as being fathers, when technically there was no real father there at all. So with that in mind, and I want you to have that in mind as we proceed, we're going to find out that the queen mother here is spoken of and not actually Belshazzar's wife. Because she's had experience now of knowing what took place a couple of generations earlier when on the throne was actually King Nebuchadnezzar. But to go a little farther about the same matter, it seems that Daniel probably had been out of the country for some time. I'm not trying to speculate, but as we go later on and read in the chapters beyond this point in Daniel, we find that he was away from the capital for some time, involved in other matters. And it very well may be that Daniel was out of the country, at least out of the immediate area, so that when Belshazzar now begins to rule, he had not heard about Belshazzar because Belshazzar was not around. He was over a province in a distant place. He was doing work in a different place, not there. So all these are good possibilities. In fact, I believe they're correct. But that's not the answer to it. That's a good answer, and it ties in with the answer. That's not the whole answer. The whole answer we'll see in just a moment. So Belshazzar, or Daniel, comes in, and he says, now you give these gifts to somebody else because I don't want them. But here's what the interpretation is, and here's what you're about to be told. Thou, O King, the Most High God, gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father, or whatever that means, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. For the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, languages trembled and feared before him, whom he would he slew, and whom he would he kept alive, and whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, his heart was made like the beast, and his dwelling was like the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven, till, so all this happened to him for 7 years, until finally at the end of that, he knew the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointed over it whomsoever he willed. He said, now Nebuchadnezzar learned that lesson. Nebuchadnezzar was taught that lesson, but you didn't learn. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this. You know what happened to your grandfather, or great-grandfather, your grandfather. But hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords, thy wives, thy concubines have drunk wine in them. Thou hast praised the gods of all these minerals, these which see, neither see, nor hear, nor know, and the God in whose hand thy breath is. The very breath you breathe is yours, because God that you do it, and whose all thy ways hast thou not glorified. So you have not taken God into your knowledge. You have not even thought about God. And all the blessings you have, and all the things you can see from your blessings, and all that surrounds you, you haven't learned your lesson yet. Then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. This is the meaning that was written. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. And this interpretation of the thing. Mene means God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting. Or it's not complete, it's lacking. And Phares, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And that's the key thought. Thy kingdom is divided, it's given to the Medes and the Persians. Then when this happened, Belshazzar, they clothed Daniel in scarlet, put a chain of gold about his neck, like he promised, and made a proclamation concerning him. He should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Third ruler in the kingdom. Three times we've mentioned that. Look at it closely again. So Belshazzar sees now what was meant for him to see. The message says that you are about to be deposed, your kingdom is taken from you, and you're going to learn that God rules. In that night was Belshazzar the king of the Chaldeans slain. Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 80 years old. And thus Babylon falls. After a long, long reign of Babylon kings, it falls. It falls to the Medes and the Persians. And so history tells us, the Bible does not. So history tells us the Medes and the Persians came in on the riverbed inside the city, undetected by anybody, and that night this king died. But is that story true? Pretty story. I enjoy it, looking at it and learning from it, and many truths are taught, but if it's not the truth, we're wasting our time. Because world history tells us there was never a king living in Babylon by the name of Belshazzar. That is, they said that until recently. But in recent excavations made in the Middle East, and we are constantly coming up with new finds. They've not too long ago found some tablets in Ebla. Of course, you remember the Dead Sea Scrolls. And all along, God has allowed man to turn upside down something he had had hidden there centuries ago. And don't you mistake this. There are things that have not yet been found. And when the time comes for those things to be found, somehow God will let somebody stumble over it. It'll be found. They're there. They're hidden. You just wait and see. Mark my word, the next 20 years, 50 years, you'll find things we haven't dreamed were there. We were not able to read these findings that were available because we do not know the ancient languages of some of the Egyptians and others who wrote until the year 1801, 1799. Along that era of time, there was a soldier who stumbled onto a stone in a place called Rosetta in the northern part of Egypt, right on the Mediterranean coast, and there were three languages there. And these three languages, side by side, were actually three languages saying the same thing. And because one of those was Greek, we were able to read the other two, and now all the beautiful things come unfolded to us that we could not read before. Hidden, men had them in their hands, you know what they said, and here's what they say. World history, of course, never acknowledged this, and couldn't acknowledge this because we didn't know it until these records, been buried in the sands and under the rocks for 1,000 years, tell us that there was indeed a man whose name was Nabopolassar, who was the king of Babylon from 625 to 606 before Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar comes on the scene at his demise and reigns till 562. Nebuchadnezzar had two children we know of, one a son and one a daughter. Now the son begins to rule after Nebuchadnezzar from 562 until 560, and his name was Ewel-Marduk in secular world, but as your Bible in 2 Kings chapter 25-27 tells you, his name was Evil-Merodach. The Bible uses that name. The Bible acknowledges him as the son of Nebuchadnezzar. That we know. And that's what the world tells us. But here's what the world didn't know about. He also had a daughter, and the daughter married a man who became the king, which was Nebuchadnezzar's son-in-law, from 560, you see, after his son died. The son-in-law reigns from 560 to 556. He also had a son, the Vashti-Marduk, who reigned for 9 months. In the meantime, the daughter's husband died, and she married another man whose name was Nabonidus. Nabonidus is the king now, of course, being the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Nabonidus, and this was well known all the time to the world, Nabonidus was, but not Belshazzar. Nabonidus ruled from 556 to 538. But during his rule, he enjoyed a leisure that many, many kings don't have. He didn't have to fight. His kingdom was placed in his hand. He was rich. There was peace. He didn't have to worry about the borders of his kingdom because his father and father-in-law had been a great soldier, conquered the world, and he was enjoying living it up as a rich monarch. And so he traveled. He enjoyed antiquities. He was a collector of items that were ancient. He traveled far and large. And in his travels, he eventually decided he would leave the control of the empire under his son, whose name was Belshazzar, who ruled from 541 to 538. But not as a king, truly, because Nabonidus was still king. But he ruled as a king in effect, for he ruled for his father as a vice king. So the real king was still Nabonidus, and the world history knows that, and Daniel knew that. But the fact is, Belshazzar, was the one who signed the papers, who issued the decrees, who made the decisions, because he was ruling in his father's stead. And now, all of a sudden, after hundreds of years of not knowing, the world knows that Belshazzar was indeed a ruler in a world history that had not been known before. He ruled 4 years. Actually, world history gives us 2 dates, 538, or you see over there, 539. But at the same time, because, and I need to say this, those years many times include the remainder of a year that is not included in one observation. Many times the entire year is used when you give a date. Many times historians do that. So we're talking about the same time, 538, 539. Belshazzar now is rid of the king, in effect, but not the king in fact. Now, let's see what we can find. World history now says that's right. World history now says that Daniel is correct. But let me show you that Daniel all the time knew he was correct, and the Bible was absolutely right all the time, because notice, 3 times it says, we'll make you the third ruler in the kingdom. Did you notice that? You remember back at the time when Joseph went down to Egypt, and when he interpreted the dream for Pharaoh, Pharaoh made him the number 2 man. Remember that? Pharaoh and Joseph. Now you remember that when Mordecai was able to inform the king, Xerxes, that you're about to be assassinated, his name was written in the record book. Later on, when Esther became the queen and things were all settled and well and done, they were reading in the record book and found that Mordecai had saved the king's life. So Mordecai is raised up to number 2 in the empire of Persia. Xerxes 1, Mordecai number 2. That was possible and proper because the king now appointed the man he wanted to favor next to him. 3 times in Daniel, he says, I'll make you the third ruler, showing he knew, in fact, he was not the first, knowing that Nabonidus was the first, I'm the second, therefore, Daniel, you'll be the third. See, the Bible very plainly covered all of the answers, every base it touched, didn't leave anything unturned. The Bible has been correct ever since it was written. God knew exactly what was going on. Daniel knew what was there before our stones had been turned, and we have seen what the real truth was. There's not an error in the Bible. In fact, not only is there not an error, but this proves conclusively that the Bible is right. It cannot be wrong. And that's the reason I believe it. And that's the reason these stories are so important. These stories in themselves are beautiful stories. They're lovely to look at, but the fact still remains, these are true. And they are proofs that God is, God knows what's going on, God tells us, he predicts these things, and well, history simply backs up what God has already said. Very quickly, we'll turn to chapter 6. We find that now a new king has come on the scene. Darius is ruling, and he is a man like many other men who enjoy being praised. But you see, Daniel was a man who was humble and conscientious and dedicated to doing the right thing for his God and for others as well. And Daniel is one who is greatly praised by the king. He's a friend of him, and he is very successful. But there is all kind of jealousy. Because, you see, Daniel is not a Persian. He was not a Babylonian. Daniel is a Jew. And Daniel has been raised up in power, and now he is at the right hand of the king. And he's one of honor and respect. In fact, he's the president of the presidents. He's the next to the highest man in the entire world, and the entire empire, which is the greatest empire in the world, that's where Daniel sits. And they couldn't stand it. They wanted to depose him, get rid of him. We've been talking the last day or two about some people who've done this recently. In fact, today we talked about that being done. And I've seen it done in the banking business in the past. Here are those who are jealous, and they're going to get rid of him because they just can't stand him. And they realize that as hard as they try, they can't find anything wrong with him. He's honest. He's sincere. He does everything right. And so they can't find anything wrong with him. What do you do then? Well, what people normally do is invent lies. And they begin to slander people and believe, and many times harm is done. You remember back in the Old Testament, that was done by Jezebel for her husband against Naboth. The Bible tells us many times where that was done. It was done against Christ. And they believed the lie, or wanted to, and crucified him. But they didn't do that this time. They said the only way we'll catch Daniel in a problem is with his God. No other way can we find a fault with him, but with his God we will. And so they came to the king, and they flattered him and suggested to him that you make a decree that for 30 days no other god will be approached except you. You're the only one. And if anybody approaches any other god in prayer except you, they'll be killed. They'll be thrown to the den of lions. And that pleased Darius. He enjoyed that because he loved the praise of that. He put himself up now on the level of a king. I must hasten. There are many other things about this I'd love to go into. About the fact that Daniel always turned and prayed toward Jerusalem, just as the Arabs do today toward Mecca. So as he was praying, and they knew that was his nature, they realized they'd catch him praying to God. And sure enough, when the decree was issued, and the decree of the Medes and Persians could not one time issue be rescinded, it had to be carried out regardless of whether the king wanted to or not. So Esther tells us about her husband. And so here Darius issued the decree. And as they knew he would, they went and found Daniel praying to his God. They brought the message back to Darius and said, "Did you not issue such and such a decree?" And he said, of course he had. And then he realized. When they told him that we have found Daniel violating your law, he realized he'd been taken. He realized what he'd done, but it was too late. He couldn't rescind the law. He couldn't change the law. And they reminded him the fact you must go through with this. And so they had Daniel where they wanted him. So they, I'm sure, went home that night smug and happy and joyful. We have our old enemy where we born him, and we're going to get rid of him. But you see, God just doesn't always work things the way people think he will. God's always there among his children. And that night, as Daniel had been thrown into the den of lions, which was his plight, the king spent his night in fasting. He wouldn't eat. He was concerned about his friend now, whom he knew, except God would intervene, would be crushed to bits by the lions. Early in the morning, he arose and went to the edge of the den of lions and called Daniel's name. Daniel responded, and the king was so pleased. He threw down whereby Daniel might be able to come up from the den of lions. Daniel was spared, and the king said that he knew his God would save him, and Daniel did. He acknowledged the fact that God is the one who brought me through this plight. But then, the decree had been followed. Daniel had not been eaten as they supposed, and now it's time for the king to make another decree. So he takes the enemies of Daniel, their wives, their children, and all they have, and throws them into a den of lions. And the Bible tells us the lions break their bones, and they're consumed. Here we have the enemies of Daniel and of God taken care of by a king's decree. I've talked about it, I don't know, an hour and 40 minutes. You've been extremely patient, and I appreciate that. I did want to get through chapter 6, and as you know, I left a lot of things untold tonight, but we must hasten. Because tomorrow night we spend the entire time on chapter 7. It'll be deep, it'll be extremely interesting, and we're going to be able then to slow down in our talk, because we're going to have to. We're going to have so many intriguing and interesting events, we're going to have to slow down and tie together a number of other scriptures that are going to give you and me insight from that time to our day and to the end of the world. Beautiful insight known by God, told to Daniel, and told to us through his writings. We appreciate so much your patience. You've been so kind to come and be with us tonight. We do hope you can return and be with us from this point forward. Should there be some things you want to ask, should there be something that I have not properly said or something that you had not understood, let me know and try to clear those things up. Again, I want to repeat, we're here to learn. I'm here to learn. And I appreciate so much your desire to do that. Now, as we stand to our feet and sing about one verse of this final song, should there be some way we might aid you in a spiritual way to better serve your God, would you let your wish be known?
161.